Hi there.
I'm Dave Bascom, and this is my 80sography.
What I wouldn't give to be when I was Mary's
Welcome to Eatersography, another My Eatersography, very much the meat and potatoes of the Eatersography pods. Sorry, apologies to any vegans out there, trigger the warning. And it's with producer, engineer, mixer Dave Bascom. I've interviewed twice for Tears of Fear's commentaries, Seeds of Love, and the songs from The Big Chair with Ian Stanley. And he was very good value, so I always meant to do the full My Eatersography experience with him. So here it is. Part one covers the first half of his 80s and is very entertaining stuff, so lead us in, Sonny.
This is the start of the interview.
Thank you for the list you sent me.
That's all right.
So do you not have like a definitive list of everything you've done? Do you not have like a definitive list of everything you've not kept a record?
Think about when you're working in the studio, is what was great about it is you're working with could be different artists every single day. And so you get through a massive amount of music and work with a massive amount of people. And my memory is pretty, well, it's not too bad actually for some of these things, but I've actually did do a bit of Googling and found a Maison Rouge list, and there's some stuff on there that I completely forgotten about. So yeah, I mean, if I kept a diary, it'd be fine, but I didn't. So what was actually the one that you put on here that I don't remember at all? Just trying to find your list.
It might not be accurate because where I got it from might not be true.
So Mark Ulrich Ophelia. Anyway,
it's funny because that's what I was playing. I was playing instrumental. So this, let me play it and see if it rings any bells. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Does this ring any bells?
But, you know, that doesn't mean I didn't bring some of it. Extended version. I was just making the tea. I have been working with Culture Club just before that as a sort of engineer stroke assistant. So I remember George asking me what Boy George was like. yeah, I sort of jumping ahead a little bit, but yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I've mentioned before to people that I was an assistant at Maison Rouge for, it felt like forever. I mean, in fact, it was a few years, but you know, when you're that age, things take forever. And I'd actually been up to Liverpool to work with Echo and the Bunnymen as an engineer, freelance engineer, even though I was still employed at Maison Rouge as an assistant. And I remember coming back, having done that, to assist and make the tea on the Wham session. And I just thought, this has got strange. I've got to do something about this, you know. But yeah. I didn't want to make the move until I had somewhere definite to go. And it wasn't a guy called Jerry Boys offered me a job at Livingston that I finally made the jump to be an actual employed as an engineer. Anyway, I've got miles ahead of myself.
You're miles ahead of me. When you went back to being a tea boy, were you committed to making the tea? Did you make a good cup of tea?
Oh, it was a shit cup of tea. That's the other reason Jerry gave me a job as an engineer, because I just disappeared for hours. It's so boring. And I just, you know.
That's the key, isn't it? Be shit at the jobs you hate and then you won't have to do them
absolutely.
Again.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No,
okay, so let's move back a little bit. So have a little bit about how you got in the business and where you were before the 80s. So what made you want to be in the music business?
Well, I always wanted to be, do music. I mean, I was always playing in a band. You know, I was playing in this band at school, age, I don't know, 14 or something. Basically, they had two guitar players. So all the other had a bass player. So I thought, I had done some piano lessons when I was a kid, and I thought, okay, well, I better be the keyboard player then. So I started doing piano lessons again and bought a little cheap organ. I was very into prog rock, so I was very into sort of Rick Wakeman and all that kind of keyboard wizardry. And so, yeah, I carried on went through a few little bands, local bands, never did anything particularly. And then I left school, I was bumbling around for a year, and the bass player, who I should credit because I've mentioned him before, but without his name, is a guy called Dave Jones. He's a great bloke, good friend of mine, and he saw an advert in Melody Maker for a junior wanted for a London studio. And he wasn't interested in that, but he thought I might be, so I went along. I got the job somehow. I still don't know how, because I had no idea how many applicants studios got in those days. They'd get, you know, dozens of letters a week. Anyway, so I got that job. I was the last one in. Maison Rouge had started life. It was owned by Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull. It started life as a mobile studio, basically in those days where people used to go and record out of the country for tax reasons. So that was the idea. He could go and record somewhere in France. And then he decided to build this bricks and mortar place in Fulham. And I was taken on just before the big opening. So my first few jobs were just literally getting, you know, cleaning the carpets and getting ready for the big opening party. And so, yeah, I started off just like every other assistant in those days, making the tea. Just sitting in sessions and learning by osmosis, by listening and seeing what other people were doing. There was no formal sort of lessons then.
Right. So what year would that have been then, your initial?
I think that was 70. Oh, God, I always get this wrong. I think it was 77. Yeah. Because I just turned 18 in 77. So I had a clean driving license. So I was loading off the drink in the bar. And that was probably all the qualifications they needed. But I had actually, because I think the other guys there weren't necessarily musicians. They hadn't been the other assistants I'm talking about. And I'd actually been in a studio. I'd done a demo with my band, 16 Tracks. So I had a little bit of experience. And even though I'd never thought about working in a studio, I was always convinced I was going to be a musician. But I was the guy in the band with the tape recorder who would always record all our sessions and rehearsals and stuff. So I'd always had a kind of interest in it. You know, when I started in the studio, I still wasn't thinking this is a career necessarily. I just thought this is a cool place to hang out. And then it got to the obvious stage where I had to do truth between overtime or rehearsals with the band, and I made the right choice. I stuck with the studio.
So you stuck with the studio, but was it clear in your mind then that I will always be behind the scenes, or were you still thinking, well, maybe once I'm set up a bit?
I think by then I probably realised that the band wasn't really going anywhere. I mean, we were still sort of doing half-assed prog rock, to be honest. And this was 1977, you know, things were moving on. Ironically, a lot of the early stuff I was doing, I mean, because it was owned by Jethro Tull, I think on my list, I put one of the, I think the, I remember the first session I actually sat in on was a Maddie Pryor session from Steely's band. So this is 1977 when punk's happening, and I was doing a Maddie Pryor. And a lot of the stuff was as uncool as that, you know. But I mean, I was a big Jethro Tull fan a few years earlier and Genesis. And obviously later on I worked with Genesis. But by then, I'd kind of moved on, you know. I wasn't into punk particularly, but I was, you know, the energy was seeping in, you know. And I was quite snobby about it. I didn't really sort of know how incredibly lucky I was to be sitting in on these sessions.
You got Mud as well. Were Mud still going after 77?
Well, no, they were kind of... I don't actually think it was the band as such. I can't quite remember. It may have been a band recording, but I know that the two guys, Rob and Ray... Rob obviously is a hugely successful songwriter now. I think we had an in-house production company and they were doing some stuff with the chief engineer, a guy called Tony Tavner. So I think they were mainly in doing that stuff. I can't quite remember. They may have had a deal with, in a record deal, but doing their own stuff just as the two of them. Can't quite remember. But Dave Edmonds, what a legend. That was some of the favourite sessions I did. I love that guy. He's just epitome of rock and roll. There's a lovely story that I remember. He was working somewhere on some of his own stuff, and he was out in the studio doing guitar solo. I was just assisting, but the engineer said, "Yeah, that was great. Do you want to hear it back?" And he said, "Nah, I'll hear it when it's on the radio."
That's either a lot of confidence or just a lack of giving a shit.
Loved his approach. He just seemed to everything was effortless and it was just good fun. And he's such a nice bloke. I mean, I remember driving, I think I'm right, he had a Rolls Royce convertible, and he pulled up next to me at the lights, you know, and I was the T-boy. And most people, you know, wouldn't even, anyway, he gave me a big wave, and it was just all, you know, there was some good old rock and roll stories going on, which I can't really talk about. Brilliant guy.
Right. So you grew up as a T-boy, you said. At what point did you start to get responsibilities within the studio?
Well, what happened a bit later, after maybe a year or two, that things started to change because we had producer engineers coming in. So originally, most of the sessions were all done by the in-house guys, which was Robin Black, who was the studio manager. He was Jethro Tull's engineer, and there was Tony Tabner. And they would do the bulk of them sessions, and we'd just be assisting. And of course, because they knew the studio inside out, there was sometimes not a lot to do. But then we started getting freelance guys coming in, and some of these guys would be engineer producers, so they'd be doing both roles. And so automatically your job as an assistant became a lot more involved. And I think the first person that I really started doing that was with David Henschel, who was obviously Genesis producer. Although I didn't do, well, actually the first session I did with him was a Genesis Live session. And the thing with him is there was no desk automation then. So he would mark all the faders out and then he'd say, "Oh, can you come over then and I'll give you your marks," which I'd never done before. So I was basically sitting at the desk with him and the two of us would be doing the mix. And then he'd ask me to do all the edits, which again, I'd never done the edits, which, you know, cutting the tape, taking all the best sections. And I'd been practicing sort of, you know, on my own time, if you like. So I sort of thought, I could just say, well, I've never done this before. You know, it's not really my job, but I just, you know, just get on with it. So anyway, we got on fine. And then, well, basically, yeah, after that, he asked me to go, I did a Renaissance album with him and another album. And then when he came to do Tony Banks's solo album, they were recording it in Sweden, and he asked me to go as a freelance assistant. I knew how he worked. So anyway, so the ball was starting to roll in that sense. You know, I started to get, not engineering quite, but, you know, I was getting a lot more responsibility and sort of, you know, the fact I was working in other studios, like Abba's studio in Sweden, where the gear was, all the equipment was completely different. So I came back brimming with sort of, oh, we should modify this. We could do it like this, you know. And it was all, I think everyone else was, wow, you know, he's kind of, a bit ahead of the game here.
Did the ABBA guys ever enter into the studio while you were there?
No, there was later on, because obviously I did two albums, Tony Banks' solo album, then Mike Rutherford's solo album, and then the Genesis album, which was Duke. And apparently they asked us out for a dinner, but we were too busy to go.
What was so important? What overdub was so important? You missed out having dinner with ABBA.
You know, it's time's money, and insane. So I know it was takeaway McDonald's as usual.
I have a question, like, what's the biggest professional disappointment? And that may well be it.
That was definitely one.
Not having dinner with ABBA.
We didn't necessarily know that the girls were going to be there, but anyway.
Still, though, Benny and Bjorn, come on.
Yeah.
Right, so trying to get the chronology right, because we're getting into 1980 almost.
Yeah, that's jumping ahead again.
You mentioned the one that excites me, the Not 9 O'Clock News, and you're talking about some BBC sessions. So
the BBC studios at Maida Vale were being refitted. I'm guessing this, I can't really remember. But anyway, we used to get quite a lot of BBC stuff in, stuff like the music for Come Dancing, as it was then, you know, before Strictly, or things like that, you know. And most of it was pretty dreadful, but it was all good training. Also, we were doing, in the same way, we were doing tons of jingles and adverts. And that, the training you get from doing those sessions is just brilliant, you know. Anyway, this particular thing was one of their songs for their show. I don't think it was Trucking. That's the one I remember.
I like Trucking.
I love Trucking.
Was it Nice Video Shame About the Song?
I can't remember. I don't think it was that one either. But it's a pretty sort of full-on fast session that you're not, you know, and you're the assistant, you're not going to barge in into, like, oh, let's have a chat, you know. But I did, you know, I remember just saying to Mel Smith, oh, I love that sketch, you know, that whatever it was they just had done the previous week, and said, oh yeah, we were pretty pleased with that too.
Great old chestnuts of the world. Number 8, the Swedish chemist's shop.
Good afternoon. Can I help you, sir? Yes, I would like some deodorant, please. Ball or aerosol?
Neither. I want it for my armpits.
I mean, we had, you know, also Spike Milligan would come in to do something for the BBC, and we get, he'd meet just, there'd be a massive throughput of people all the time in a sort of a studio like that. The other thing I mentioned was these Top of the Pop sessions. I don't, do you know about these Top of the Pop sessions you used to have to do? Is anybody...
Is that what, because they would, they have to record versions to perform as opposed to the record,
Just absolutely nonsense, absolutely absurd. But anyway,
what,
so...
What was the rule for it, though? Because it seemed like some did and some didn't. What was the dividing line? Well,
everyone was supposed to. Some people either got caught swapping the tapes, which is what they did, or they just decided they couldn't be asked, with the stress of it all, they just sort of... And if, you know, if you were a band, you could... where you had, you could record it quite quickly. You know, why not have a go? Some people enjoy doing it live again, but, you know, if you, Frankie goes to Hollywood and you spend 6 months making it relax, let's recreate that in 3 hours. It's just fun. it's, you know, it's a hangover from the bloody 50s where, you know, Cliff Richard would go in and with an orchestra and cut it in 3 hours. And the MU thought, well, this is just going to be on Top of the Pops. Then the musicians should get something out of it, and so we're going to book them again for the same thing. And their thinking hadn't moved on. And anyway, the point was, we got you get a lot of these sessions coming in, so you get to meet all sorts of bands that were doing Top of the Pops, which, you know, so they're all quite happening. The Bow Wow Wow one, I remember, because I was engineering by then, skipping forward, and Annabella only turned up half an hour before the session, and this was like, it was mind games, because the musicians' union guy had come in early on. He sort of sat next to me and said, "Oh, look, don't worry, I'm cool. You know, you're right. I know what's going on." I thought, well, what do you mean by that? Do you mean, you know, I'm going to stop the tapes? Or, you know, or you sort of, I know what happened, how studios, well, what does he say? So I couldn't sort of trust him. So Annabella turns up, literally with time to do one take. She wanted her headphones so loud that they were feeding back on the mic. And I went to, don't worry, we'll sort that out in the mix. So the A&R guy, recording guy, takes the MU guy off to the bar, which is their job. And I was actually going through the motions of mixing it, just for partly for fun and partly for in case he came back in, which he did. Sits down next to me and says, "So, what are you going to do to fix that noise then?" I thought, fuck off. You know, just, is this a wind up? You know, I just had a sort of baloney, make up any old crap, and then swap the tapes anyway. But yeah, so they could be pretty stressful, because people did get, you know, blacklisted if they were caught doing this sort of stuff. I know Tears for Fears were shitting themselves. I mean, what, did we say this on the last one with Ian? I can't remember. Yeah, they were really nervous with the first, before in my day, but. On the first few singles, the threat of being blacklisted. So they could be pretty stressful sessions.
So did they re-record theirs then? Did they do Mad World? Because it sounds like...
Well, no one did. I mean, they went through the motions, but they certainly wouldn't have.
Okay,
so... the only one...
Everyone went through the rigmarole of doing it, but everyone then just switched the tapes and just played the record.
Yeah, but occasionally you'll hear, you know, someone singing... Yeah, you know, the version's slightly different on the telly, on Top of the Pops, because they may have sung the vocal live or, you know, whatever. I do remember Wuthering Heights, though, Kate Bush, and, oh, God, poor Kate. She's singing away with the BBC orchestra, absolutely murdering it. They just couldn't... They're all pissed. They couldn't give a shit. They were doing it live, and you know, she's just struggling away. And it's the first TV, you know, it's Top of the Pops, and it's just awful.
You just want to hear the record, don't you?
That's... Yeah, well, absolutely.
Is the lovely number one sound across the nation, Kate Bush, once again for the third week running, and Wuthering Heights. Well, everyone's been a winner, and we'd like to say good night until next week's Top of the Pops. Good night!
1980.
So, 1979, like you said, Tony Banks' first solo LP, A Curious Feeling, and that leads to 1980. We went to 1989 with Mike Rutherford's first solo LP, Small Creeps Day. So, what was the biggest difference between working with Tony and working with Mike?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, they're very different. Well, first of all, the Tony experience was very odd because, as I said, David Henshall had asked me out to be his assistant, but he had measles or mumps for the first week. So I was completely thrown in at the deep end. And I did see Tony actually about a year ago, and he said, "How green were you?" It was a funny word. Just no one really says that anymore. But yeah, I was. I had done a bit of engineering, but mainly just messing, you know, practicing with my mates' bands. So I don't know whether I'd actually done any professional engineering as it was, but I said, yeah, I'll be fine, you know. Yeah, so the first week, or maybe, I think it was the first week, we're doing basically all the backing tracks with Chester Thompson on drums. I was engineering that. It sort of seemed to go okay, but Tony's, you know, he's a funny guy, very dry. After when we finished the backing tracks, Chester had gone, then David Henschel turned up and we just got on with it, and it was quite, it was just the three of us there, and it was quite, we just got on with it, I think, whereas with Mike, there was Anthony Phillips was there playing, who was one of the founder members of Genesis. He was doing keyboards. So it was a bit, there's a few more people around. And it was probably more fun, I think. Mike's a bit more relaxed, a bit more easygoing than Tony. You know, for instance, when we were doing guide vocals so that we could send these tapes off so the singer could learn the songs. But, you know, we could muck about with Mike, sort of wind the berry spray up as he's doing that's really childish. So you just speed the tape up and up and up. To see when he notices, and it took him literally double speed before he actually thought what's going on, because he was having such a hard time just the concept of singing. So, anyway, so yeah, it was more relaxed. I actually like the Tony's album. It's pretty good. I think. I mean, I'm saying I'm a Genesis fan anyway, so
yeah.
I think it's a better album than Mike's, to be honest.
Do you like the last track on Mike's, though, at the end of the day? I think
that's classic. But yeah, the drum sounds are a lot better. I mean, it was because one of the reasons they went to this Abbott Studios because they had this live room where Zeppelin had been. And you know, there's a bit of a misconception about Genesis, certainly back then. You know, they were kind of a bit folky and proggy, but they wanted to be tougher, you know, and they wanted this liver sound. But when I arrived to do with Chester Thompson to do the Tony album, Chester put his drums up in the really super dead bit, very sort of traditional 70s sounding, and I hadn't really got the bottle to say, no, I didn't know what the plan was for the album, so I never said to him, look, let's fucking move it. Nah, let's move it out. And Tony didn't either, so hence the drums are quite polite on that album. And then come Mike's album, we had Simon Phillips, and it was all done in the live room, so it's got a lot more balls to it.
So you go from working on the solo albums to, it's a natural progression then to work on the next Genesis album.
Yeah.
How involved was your role on that, and how much were you there the whole time?
Yeah, start to finish. That's pretty much, yeah. I mean, actually, I was going to say that's how it went, but it didn't. But no, on these particular sessions, it did. I can't really imagine doing that now. I just knew every single note, which you had to, because the tape, just on a technical level, the tapes were so chock-a-block. You have, like, on one track, you'd have like a tambourine in the middle bit, and then a guitar solo, and then a harmony vocal. And you'd have to know exactly what all these parts were, because if you were recording this harmony vocal and the guitar solo's come out, if you didn't switch out recording time, you'd wipe the guitar solo and that was it was gone forever. So I think that was one I was quite reliable, you know, David Henschel would trust me to be able to deal with all that, and they were hugely complex bits of music. And then, as I say, I'd help out on the mix. Basically, David would mark all the faders, just different China Garden colours for different parts of the song, tell me what was what, and we'd just sit there and, you know, and just sort of tweak it and work away. So yeah, I was very much part of it, and it was really, really enjoyable. I say now, I sort of pinch myself, you know, thinking, bloody hell, having the chance to work on a Genesis album would have seemed, for the me, you know, 6 years earlier, 14-year-old me or something, would have just been an utter out of this world. But by the time, I was kind of like, yeah, it's good, but it's like, I'm over this. But yeah, it's a good album, actually. I'm watching Phil Collins play drums was one of the highlights of my life. I mean, he was just the best drummer. You could see before, I mean, Peter Gable said something like this on an interview, but he just sat down at the kit, and before he played anything, he knew he was good. It's like sitting in he's so comfortable, like sitting in an armchair, and he's just so relaxed, and it's just so effortless. What a feel. You know, it's just fantastic. In fact, years later, my mate Nick Davis, who became Genesis co-producer, engineer for the last 20 years or so, he remixed all the whole catalogue in 5.1 and he mastered it in Metropolis, and I had a room there, so every time he came in he'd say, "I'll come and have a listen." And when he was doing Duke, it was just fantastic, because it's like being back in the room again, you know, because it's all surround sound, you're hearing the wet detail. It was a real time travel, you know. It really was. The other thing about Genesis is they never put any vocals on until the end, until everything else is recorded, so you never heard the vocal money. And I found a lot of the time there's so many melodic elements going on anyway in the music that you become locked into that, and that was, you focus on that. When the vocals came on, it was a huge disappointment. Suddenly all that stuff was smothered. You know, the vocals would be the worst bit for me on some of the tracks.
You'd rather have had a Genesis instrumental album, would have been better for you.
I'd love to have heard that. Yeah, I mean, in fact, I should have asked Nick to run off, like maybe he probably did, but yeah.
So famously, Duke was the album where Phil Collins started writing songs and presented songs to the band, including, he says, In the Air Tonight.
Yeah.
So I assume that all happened before they got into the studio, that when you got to the studio, they had the arranged songs they were going to do.
Yes. Yeah, everything was pretty much, ready to go. They're very well rehearsed. You know, it's all, you know, there's a few changes. I mean, Turn It On Again is the one that most fundamentally changed, because it never had the end section on. There was some story originally, I didn't know this, but it was part of some sort of conceptual thing where it was going to run into another song, and then they changed their minds. So basically it just went, and I can still remember, it went the fourth time around, it was from down, do, 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 down, do, 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 down, down, boom. And that was it. So, and we left it like that. We recorded the backing track. We got the master one evening, went off, had something to eat, knocked it off for the night. And then we came back in the morning and they'd been thinking about it. And I thought, no, we want to extend it. So everything was still set up, luckily. So we just came in, played along to the track. And then they did the end section. And then I edited it on. And that's, of course, the bit where you get the hook coming in. Turn it on, turn it on, turn it on again. So that was obviously the big hit on the album. So it was...
Yeah, it's a fantastic track. No, it's one of my favourite songs of the 80s, actually, Turn It On Again. It's a brilliant track. I mean, Duke, I could talk about Duke for ages, because it's such an important album. It's kind of, it's the one album that kind of links prog Genesis to pop Genesis.
Very much, yeah.
It's a perfect bridge, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, totally.
Okay, so we're into 81. One track on the Level 42 album, The Pursuit of Accidents, you're listed on. Is that correct?
It's only one track.
And one place I found, because it just says you and that album, but it doesn't specify which tracks, and one place it mentioned one track.
I've got no idea, but again, that was assisting, and that came in halfway through the album, so I probably worked on a few, to be honest, but they may have mentioned that one, because I do remember they're running out of time, and... Ahmet Ertegun, terrible name, had turned up to sort of supervise, I suppose, the end of the album or whatever, or help out. So basically they booked both studios, Studio 1 and Studio 2 at Maison Rouge. So the producer and the engineer and the rest of the band were in Studio 2 finishing whatever they were doing. And I went into Studio 1 to do vocals with Mark King and with Ahmet producing the vocals. So that, and I was kind of engineering that, so that may be why they gave me credit for that. And I can't remember the song, but... yeah, I mean, that would kind of make sense. Take a journey back in time. Leave the Western world behind. Cross the mountains to Peking. Yeah.
And I'm trying to clarify what you did with Culture Club, whether it was...
I did the first two singles. Leading on from that thing about producer engineers, Steve Levine, their producer, was the same thing. He was an engineer and producer. So I was very much more than just the assistant then, and I was helping to engineer stuff. So I did the first two singles. I did White Boy and I'll Tumble For You. So I did the first two flops just before.
They dumped you and they got success, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Your white sounds like an enemy. Your white sounds like an enemy. Your white sounds like an enemy.
What were you doing on those sessions then?
Well, it's basically assisting, really, but I engineered bits and pieces. I seem to remember doing a B-side, and I think it's got a kid rapping on it. It may have been Jeremy Healy, but I may be completely wrong. Steve Levine was very much into recording it, all the effects live. A few people did in those days. It was very decisive. So basically, I was doing all the kind of dubby echoes live as he was doing it, which, you know, if you get it wrong, you're stuck with it. So, yeah, it's not quite as hands-on as with David Henschel, but more than just being a tape-op, because if someone's producing and engineering, they need more help with, you know, the engineering side of it, really.
Right.
And just looking at your list, actually, when you say, because I didn't have my screen up. Yeah, 1978, Pastiche Survivor. I assume this is incorrect. Well, it's not The Survivor.
So it's correct and incorrect.
But it's my mates. It was a mates band, actually, and that's an example of the things, the bands I would get in to sort of basically practice on. And they put it out as an EP. And on the back of that, I thought, well, I'll try and get a deal for them. So it was just in, you know, a weekend dead studio time. And 1978. That's weird, because I think I was doing all the. I must have been starting to work with David Henschel, because I remember nicking a lot of his tricks. So anyway, I sent these tapes off in Maison Rouge tape boxes, because I thought that made it look a bit more posh. And no one wanted to sign them, but this guy at EMI said, well, I don't want the band, but it sounds great. Can you do some freelance engineering for me? So again, if this was 1978, I'd only been there a year. I think it must have been a bit later than that. But it was an Iron Maiden live gig filmed for a video, I guess, or whatever. I had no idea what to charge. In fact, we used the mobile. So technically, I was an employee of the studio. And he said, I'll just charge what the musicians charge, which is 300 quid a day, I think, back then. So I got the receptionist to type up the invoice. And my boss, Robbie, walked past and said, fucking hell, it's more than I'm getting. Yeah. So there was a few incidences like that where I sort of, you know, I got a bit of a leg up. And I thought people then could see that I could be trusted. So on the back of that, I would start, you know, I think the first thing I ever heard of mine properly on the radio was an advert for Avon, which, because we had an agency called Airedale who did tons of jingles there. And of course, they knew me as just the T-boy. You know, they've known me since I started. And suddenly I got this gig, but I'd been put on the session as an engineer, which must have been pretty nerve-wracking for them and me. But it went really, really, really well. I've got a tape of it somewhere. It's really funny good. So, you know, I was kind of getting, I suppose, you know, to be trusted and a safe pair of hands and stuff.
So I hope that when Eye of the Tiger came out, you put Survivor on your CV.
No.
You have to specify which Survivor, do you? Yeah, I've worked with Survivor.
Yeah, yeah.
That would look good, wouldn't it? 81 then. So we've got a Marcy Webb LP.
Yeah.
Correct? An Elkie Brooks LP.
Yeah.
And Twisted Sister.
Yeah. Well, Elkie Brooks, actually, that's interesting. That was produced by Gus Studgeon, who I'm sure you know is legendary. Yeah. And I did quite a lot of work with him as an assistant. By then, I was really getting sick of assisting. And he was, you know, he's a fantastic producer and a brilliant person. Really funny. Great sessions were great fun. But, you know, it's fair to say he was doing his middle of the road period. I mean, Elkie Brooks says it all, really. And it was, you know, so I wasn't interested in music at all, really. But yeah, I learned a lot from him. So you just absorb the sound that the people are getting, you know. He's not really sort of looking to see what they're doing necessarily, but you just pick it up. Marty Webb, that was David Henschel. Yeah, that was quite a bit. Well, it felt like years after the Genesis stuff. But yeah, I think I well, a usual thing with him, helping out on the mixing. Twisted Sister, yeah, they're nice them to give me the credit, because I think it was only feels like a few days I worked with them. But I think they may have had their own engineer, and so, you know, I was the guy who's showing them the ropes at the studio and stuff. So.
So when you're working with Alki Brooks and then Twisted Sister, is from your point of view, is the job still pretty much the same? Or do you think this is like 180 degrees?
Well, that's the thing you learn when you're in the studio. That's the other thing about learning in a student environment like this, is that you appreciate every kind of different music. So when I started, I was a huge snob. You know, I did a lot of stuff with the session guys who did Jerry Rafferty. And they're all great players, but I've always had a bit of a thing about session guys. You know, it's always... It's a bit bland for me, and I was very snobby about it. I thought, oh, stupid little amps and little twee guitar sounds. Everything should be fucking through a Marshall. But, you know, quite quickly you learn, no, actually, they're really bloody good. They know what they're doing, and you come to appreciate the skill and everything. And it's great, you know, even if you don't like the music, if you end up with a good sounding record, especially with me these days when I'm mixing, if I get something I'm not that keen on, I end up liking it. I think, well, okay, probably means I've done a good job. So that's part of the pleasure of what I do. So, yeah, they're really, you know, you were working with so many different artists every single day that it wasn't as much of a leap you'd think. And I think a good engineer, not that I am particularly, but, you know, should be able to do any kind of genre of music, I always thought.
Is there a genre of music you prefer engineering or producing? Do you find more satisfying? Something you like to listen to, but just to actually work on?
I think indie kind of bands, you know, bands, the dynamic is there in the playing if you're lucky, you know, and if it's well done. It sort of mixes itself. When you've got, you know, like a electronica or, you know, R&B, so much of the dynamics and the arrangement you have to bring out in the mix with, you know, something that is probably going to be quite static if it's coming from a drum machine, for example. Yeah, I've always liked, I mean, a band, you know, particularly, I mean, I always think of James, for example. I did quite a lot of work with them. And you can tell their arrangements have been, they're really odd, a lot of them, like, sit down. You know, it's got some really odd sections, but you know they've kind of been hammered out in a rehearsal studio. And you'd never get that from a conventional songwriter. I'm going off a tangent here, but, you know, you'd never get that on an Alki Brooks session because a songwriter wouldn't write like that. And I love the fact that bands come up with interesting arrangements through that process of having a few different guys chipping in ideas. Then they play them maybe live, you know, or certainly rehearsals, and they thrash through the arrangements. And they've got all the dynamics of there, you know, when you're going into the chorus, the drummer will do a fill. You don't have to manufacture something. Yeah, that's certainly my favourite.
Welcome to the Made in Scotland 80s podcast, a podcast celebrating the golden era of Scottish bands and albums during the 1980s, 1990s and a hint of 2000s. Join me for some in-depth interviews and stories with the artists who are keeping the 80s alive and kicking on Made in Scotland 80s.
Item 1982 1983.
You mentioned before Wham, Young Guns.
Yeah,
so you said you worked on the 12-inch.
I'm pretty sure, you know, I really can't remember the post, but I think it was that. Yeah,
and you had interaction with George Michael while doing it
briefly. Yeah, I mean, again, I was sitting in the corner not saying much, but he did ask me about Boy George, and so we had a bit of a chat. And I do remember being actually very impressed because they weren't hands-on, you know, him and Andrew, but the producing engineer were putting an effect a delay on something. And I remember George piped up and said, can you change that for a much shorter delay, which actually sounded much more cool, much more modern. And I thought, fucking hell, is this guy, for a young kid who'd hardly ever been in a studio, I thought that was really smart. So you could instantly see that guy, the skill, you know.
He had brilliant instincts at a very young age.
Yeah.
Didn't he?
And that was, I remember, before they'd ever had any success, you'd never know. Obviously, you're working with people all the time. 90% of them, you're never going to see the light of day. But I thought, Christ, it's a fantastic, fantastic song. This is the lead for the major moves, as I say, started out really tossing up the tail in the prog rock, and then they went through a period, starting around 98, I suppose, where we were getting Wham, Culture Club, but it suddenly became uber hip, which was great. I loved this sort of brand new shiny pop stuff. And Duran came in later, obviously, they were there all the time.
A long way from Maddie Pryor.
Exactly. Probably 2 years or 3 years, you know.
Looking at your CV, you've done a lot of single mixes and that, but I don't see many 12-inch mixes. So did you do many 12-inch mixes?
No, I never. They sort of started around that, I suppose, that early 80s period. And now, God, it was always the thing you'd done when you finished the bloody main mix at 2 o'clock in the morning. And yeah, in theory, it could be a lot of fun. But actually, you know, to make a really good one, you had to bloody work hard at it. And I was always so knackered, you know. It's just, I didn't really enjoy that whole kind of extended mix. I like a definitive version, you know. I don't want to listen to 29. I mean, I can't bear the remixes. I mean, especially with something like Erasure, you know, you go on Spotify, or I remember at the time, you know, you get fucking every 10 people doing mix. Some of them might be great, but I don't give a shit. You know, I can't hate that. So, anyway, I never had any interest in it, and I was never in the situation to really do many.
Okay.
1983.
So we're moving into 1983, and what I assume would have been quite a big album was Porcupine, Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah. Well, according to you, they're on the same year, but I thought Echo and the Bunnymen was earlier than that. But anyway, so yeah, Echo and the Bunnymen I mentioned that was so interesting because I say we were just starting to do people like Wham, Culture Club, Maison Rouge, and then I was working with another producer engineer called George Nicholson, who liked me. I was the assistant, but again, I was doing more than assisting. He recommended me to a guy called Max Hull, who was head of A&R at Warner Brothers. So Max was looking for an engineer to do this Echo and the Bunnymen album, and he asked me, so, which is brilliant. So I went up to Liverpool. Ian Brody was producing it, who I still see all the time. Really good mate. But it was a complete culture shock for me because Maison Rouge in Fulham, you know, it was the height of the 80s fashions were coming in. We were doing very sort of shiny pop. This was all, you know, long overcoats down this last thing. And then I came back and I made this John Miles thing you've got on, which I hardly remember, but that might have been around the same time when I came back and I was still making the tea for fucking Wham and all these people. That's when I left, you know, pretty much. Yeah. I must have left in 83, I think, because H2O, Dream to Sleep, which you've got, that was done when I'd left and I was working at a place called Livingston. So that was actually my first. Echo and the Bunnymen, I didn't really see the guys, you know, after we finished the album, I didn't really keep in touch. I didn't know what had happened. I mean, I think they'd probably had a bit of a hit with the cutter, but it didn't really feel that involved. Whereas H2O was really the first engineering thing I'd done, which was a hit. It was their first single. We were still making the album when that came out. We went to the Top of the Pops. So it's just a hugely exciting time for me. I mean, the first time you go to the Top of the Pops, it's such a buzz.
So was that the first major project where you were the main engineer?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've engineered the Becca and the Bunnymen. I had done a lot of engineering for people, but by this time I was the house engineer at Livingston Studios, so I officially never had to make the tea again. I did It's Immaterial around the same time, actually the same producer as H2O, but we were the same age, so, you know, I'd hang out, I'd go and stay in the hotel with them just for fun, you know, and so that was a great time, really exciting time for me. Things started to sort of move in a good direction.
That's a good album, actually, Faith. I really enjoyed listening to that. But Dream to Sleep, I remember that track from, like, not had listened to it for like 30 years. It's a great single.
It is a really good song, isn't it?
Not singles of the 80s, isn't it? You never hear anymore. Yeah. But it's a good song.
Well, they didn't really have anything after that, but yeah, it was a really, really good song.
Dancing together, tangled emotions, flashing, you turn your face away. Silent persuasion, the reshape my future, and I'll never be the same again. I dream to sleep, I sleep to dream. I dream to sleep, I sleep to dream.
Did that jump out at you as being a singer when you were making it? Like,
absolutely, yeah, that was the intention. It's a bit like Do You Want to Hurt? It wasn't typical of their stuff at the time.
Yeah.
Same thing. I don't think they really fought against it, which I know Boy George certainly did, because the two singles I did with Culture Club were kind of much more Burundi. It was, you know, kind of like Bow Wow Wow. Where, you know, but these Do You Want to Hurt Me and Dream to Sleep were kind of slightly ballady, you know, slower. But yeah, they were good choices for singles.
I'm so glad you didn't work on Karma Chameleon, because it's my song of the 80s. So.
Yeah.
I was about to say, oh, yeah, Karma Chameleon. Oh, it's great work, Dave. And
I probably agree with you there.
I haven't got a bullshit, so that's good.
You come and go. You come and go.
Not this record! Not this record! Not this record!
1984.
Yeah.
Talk about Foxhole by Freeze Frame.
Yeah.
You got credits as backing vocals as Colonel Bascom. Is that correct? Is there any bells?
Backing vocals? I don't remember that at all.
But were you labelled as Colonel Bascom? That's the question.
Well, Foxhole was this military thing, wasn't it?
You know? Yes.
Yeah. That's actually because the studio in Liverpool, Amazon Studios, where I'd done Echo and the Bunnymen, and I'd done a few other bits and bobs up there, but they started asking me to come and do stuff up there, which is, and Freeze Frame, I think, was one of the first things I did as a producer, which would have been that EP.
It could be peaceful, it could be frightened, or I could be active without the fighting. I'll never get the chance to change your mind. I'll never get the chance to comfort your
Yeah, King, won't you hold my hand now? Yeah, I was assisting on that. That was still at Maison Rouge. This is all these things around this period are all a bit, it was a change over time, really, when I was.
Yeah, no, like the King song is just one track. So was it just like, oh, we need you just to do this job on this day? Or was it just the fact that you were working on many different things and have time to commit to one project?
No, I was just the assistant. So it would have been, maybe I did engineer it. God, I can't remember now. No, I did engineer that, I think. I think I was just—I really can't remember. Actually, I can't remember. That was—I know it was a Maison Rouge, so I was probably getting quite busy then. It must have been. Now, maybe I went back to meet. I can't remember now. I do remember working, this guy called Liam Henschel, I think, who produced it. I did some stuff, more stuff with him later on. A band called Terraplane, actually, yeah.
Okay, yes. I did have a listen to some of that, yeah. And of course, 84, there's a little matter of you getting involved with a band called Tears for Fears.
Yeah.
You may have talked about them in the past. Obviously, when it comes to Songs from the Big Chair, I urge people to listen to the audio commentary you did with Ian Stanley, which is, I think, my favourite episode. Just brilliant and entertaining. But just to try and cover different areas we haven't covered in those conversations. So do you remember your first contact, how you first got involved?
Yeah.
And the first time you met Kurt and Roland?
Yeah, well, that again, that was this guy, Max Hole, I mentioned earlier, who was giving me quite a lot of work for WEA Records, it was, including It's a Material, various bits and pieces. And he hadn't signed Tears for Fears, but he managed Chris Hughes, who was their producer. And they decided not to use the engineer who'd done The Hurting for various reasons. And so they were in a studio and they hadn't booked an engineer. So literally, Max rang me at home and said, "Are you busy today?" And I said, "No." And I said, "You want to go and work with Tears of Fear?" So I told him to fuck off. And shut up there, whizzed up there, which is, I mean, they were one of my favourite bands. So it was just, that was a huge turning point for me. So yeah, I got to the studio. As you can tell, I always forget people's names, and I forgot Chris's name. So I was kind of wandering around going, there's a producer here. You know, I wasn't sure who I was supposed to talk to. Impressive start. Yeah, so I met them there, and Ian was programming a sequence apart on Mother's Talk, which is the track that we're working on, and they had a technical problem with it, which I managed to fix sort of fairly quickly, so that was quite a good start. They were quite impressed with that, I think.
Yeah.
And it was downhill from there on.
Ian Stanley, when I interviewed him the first time, told a story about when it's a curtain round had gone off to film the Mother's Talk video.
Yeah.
They're walking back to the studio. You'd recorded the live drums and you're playing it. It's almost like a Hollywood moment where you're playing like the finished version of the live drums and they were coming going, "Wow, what's that sound? That's amazing." Does that ring any bells? Or was that one of Ian's stories?
No, I don't remember that at all. He's just making it up. No, I mean, he's probably right. I can't. You know, everyone's memories are different, but I don't know what. See, if he was doing the video for Mother's Talk, that would have been something else. That would have been later on in the album. I did mention last time that the solo on Everyone Wants to Rule the World, at the end, Neil Taylor's solo,
yeah,
they were away for that. And then Roland came back and said, "Bloody hell, I'm amazed you can get a decent sound without me around."
Yeah, yeah.
Ian's probably talking about Shout when they, yeah, that must be it. Yes, of course that would be it. Because, you know, obviously just Shout was just the chorus, the first, like a mantra thing. And then, Chris and Ian were, well, that's before I was involved. Chris and Ian had taken it and put these big drums on. So that must be what he's talking about. Because, yeah, Roland mentions that in the documentary.
They made Mother's Talk before Shout. So you involved Mother's Talk.
Yeah, we did Mother's Talk, and then they'd asked me to do the album. And it all went really quiet. It felt like months and months. And I was convinced they'd chosen someone else, you know. And I'd ring up Chris occasionally, didn't want to hassle him too much, but I'd ring him up every week or so. And he'd say, "Yeah, we're still working, don't worry, I'll give you a shout." And it turns out that's what they were doing. They were working on Shout, which was, it took a long time to get that from literally that one chorus to the whole fleshed out song. And once that was ready to go, then we started the album in earnest. I had been down to see them all, you know, we'd sort of talked about setting the studio up. And then, as I say, I thought the whole gig had gone away. and I was just finishing off some other bits and pieces, and then I got the call to go down and start the rest of the album.
Okay, so to clarify, so you were brought on board for Mother's Talk.
Yeah.
There was a gap where they made Shout.
Yeah.
And then there's a doing the album fully, because there's two singles.
Yeah.
As they're continuing the album, they brought you on board to finish the album and do the rest of the album, basically.
Yeah, yeah, no, but they've done the demo of Shout, and then once that was ready to go, then we started the whole thing, the rest of the album. So we started the proper recording of Shout, all the other tracks, and
But you don't remember them recording the live drums on Shout, and
it wasn't the live drums. It wasn't. I think Ian's got that wrong. It was the drum below. It's the boom, boom, da, ba, do, boom, da, 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 you know.
At the end of the song, doesn't Chris Hughes come in with the drum?
Yeah, they didn't do that on the demo. That was
No. But I'm talking when they're recording it. So as they recorded on that overdub of the live drums, was that when they came back and said, "Wow, that's amazing"?
No,
no. At no point did they come back.
Roland was there all that way through, telling Chris
all the way through. Okay, makes sense that during the Mother's Talk video, while they're making that, you'd be working on Shout at the same time. So that timeline kind of works out. You're saying there's no crossover. Well, they came back from that and heard something else.
While they're doing the Mother's Talk video, Ian and Chris would be working on the demo for Shout.
On the demo. Okay. Well.
Yeah, they did disappear at certain other times during the process. I remember Roland being there because he was telling Chris he was shit.
What was he shit about the drum?
Oh, he was just just occasionally. Because it was just an overdub snare drum, so we were dropping in where it was like,
Best. Okay, so take a break from the years, and you've done your little bit of research for your favourites of the 80s.
Oh, Christ, yeah.
Favourite film of the 80s?
Favourite film, okay, I did go have a think about this. Okay, so there's a few contenders I'll give you. Airplane, which came on the other day. I mean, it's still fantastic.
Nervous?
Yes.
First time?
No, I've been nervous lots of times.
Wings of Desire, I love that. Blade Runner, Betty Blue, but I think that's just amazing. I think probably it's a bit cliche, but With Nail and I think it's just a great, it's not even set in the 80s, but it's just, I love that juxtaposition of the two complete slobs, especially in the bit where they're in the tea room, and you know, it's just so funny, and it's got some great lines. So that's probably my favourite, I guess.
We're working on a film up here. Location, see? We might want to do a film in here.
You're drunk.
Just bring out the tapes. Cake and fine wine.
If you don't leave, we'll call the police.
Balls. We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here, and we want them now.
Miss Brenner has it. Telephone the police.
It's all right. Miss Brenner has it. I'm warning you. If you do, you're fired.
Yes, weird. You're the first person to pick that film, right? I thought, really? Yeah.
Give us some other ones, though. Give us some other ones that people have picked.
Blade Runner's come a lot. Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap, obviously, but I've seen that so many times I can't watch it.
Death Cells.
I think he's right. There's something about this that's so black. It's like, how much more black could this be? And the answer is none. None
is that good?
More black.
Your favourite TV programme or series of the 80s?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I was just being facetious, I was going to say Going Live. At least I love watching that in the mornings. Yeah, that was great. The Tube, a bit more sensibly. But I think, actually, the first one I came to my head when he asked me this was Boys from the Black Stuff, which is just...
Oh, right, yeah.
And they actually repeated that recently, and I watched it again. And obviously, it's dated, but it's still really powerful.
Giz a job. Go on, giz it. Giz, go on. I could do that. You don't have to walk straight. I can walk straight. Go on, giz a job.
I hadn't considered at the time, but that's what Liverpool was like when I first went up there to work with Echo and the Bunnymen. It was literally, well, the same time. And it was grim, you know. It was really, especially coming from a London which was getting all shiny and gentrified. Liverpool certainly wasn't. And I think that was a, it's a, this is an amazing document at the times.
Years, does it still hold up?
Yeah, it's obviously dated, a lot of the factors, but it does. It really does. I mean, you can, the emotions, the power, it's really powerful, you know. Yeah, there's, I mean, there's a bit, obviously, Yoz's story, you might remember. Most people, that's probably my favourite thing. But there's one actually with, I can't remember the other guy's name, but he ends up having a huge rouse with his wife, Julie Walters, and he ends up going and killing his pet. He's got a pet duck or something, or a pet goose. And he goes, they're so hungry. He goes and kills his pet goose, you know, and it's just, it's fucking, oh, it's devastating.
I remember that. Yes. God, yeah, I remember that.
Well, I'm just thinking about it. It's just, oh, it's, that was one, actually, that was the most powerful one.
Hey, somebody better wash the blood off that rabbit.
Good choice. Favourite book of the 80s?
Oh, God. This is really difficult because I read a hell of a lot, but I can't remember anything particularly I read. Okay, I was going to say, this is a cheating one because it's Confederacy of Dunces, but I didn't read that in the 80s. I've just read it recently. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. But I think probably Money by Martin Amis. I think that was 82 or something, wasn't it? I don't know.
Why that one?
Well, again, it's a bit like One Brother Vanities in terms of it's the 80s excess. I mean, this is horrible character, John Selby. Well, he's just the most revolting stereotype you could get of kind of greed and excess. But it's a sort of cartoony. I like those kind of books. I mean, it's very, very funny. And I like the kind of cartoonish aspects of, you know, just taking it as far as you can. But again, it really is 80s excess written down, I think. I love Martin Amis anyway. He's great.
You want a drop of this?
No, thanks. I try not to drink at lunchtime.
Yeah, so do I. I'll never quite make it.
I feel like shit all day if I drink at lunchtime.
Me too. I feel like shit all lunchtime if I don't.
Yeah, well, it all comes down to choices, doesn't it? It's the same in the evening. Do you want to feel good in the evening, or do you want to feel good in the morning? It's the same with life. Do you want to feel good old, or do you want to feel good young? One or the other, not both.
Okay, so your favourite album in the 80s you weren't involved with?
Probably Colour of Spring.
Yes, that just come up.
I mean, I love the ones after as well, but that was, that was still, it was slightly poppy, you know, and it's kind of, it's just a great album. I played that to death in Tears of Fear. They were all really into that as well, and it was just expanding things, you know, the looseness of the arrangements and having these great musicians, but they weren't being muso, they were just, you know, they're so free. They're getting into this kind of more jazzy looseness that they got into very much later on. But it's still structured. It's obviously programmed still. So, wonderful, wonderful textures, wonderful playing.
Yeah, you can hear that. And it would have been an influence on Seeds of Love, actually. That is individual great pop songs, but as a whole, it has this kind of mood to it.
Yeah, well, we got some of the same. We've got Mark Felton, who's the harmonica player. We've got Robbie McIntosh in to play, does guitar on it. I mean, I'm the producer. Tim Fries Green, genius.
It's Green, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually reached out to him to see if he wanted to do an interview about it. He said, no, I don't really want to talk about it because it's all in the music. I thought, that's fair enough. That's a good answer.
Yeah.
From the place that I stand to the land that is open, live free. Watching rivers run black are the trees that are vacant to green.
Okay, best live event attended in the 80s.
This was a difficult one because I just can't remember any that particularly stood out.
Did you go to many gigs in the 80s?
No, not that I remember. Nothing particularly that really sticks out. I mean, what I'd like to say is some sort of really, you know, some sort of intimate performance with someone like Tom Waits. That's been quite hip thing to say, but I don't remember anything like that. So all I could come up with was, I saw Radiohead supported by Placebo. Actually, this must be the 90s. No, of course, that's not right. Yeah, so scrub that. I can't even bloody remember now. I can't give any standout ones.
That's fine. Right. And song you wish you had produced?
Probably Cloud Busting. It's Kate Bush.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Anything you'd have done differently to it?
Well, no. So it's a bit of a weird question, isn't it? I mean, I've just like sort of done. No, there's only you could. I couldn't improve on that.
Thanks. So that was part one of the interview. Massive thanks to Dave, as always. Such an eclectic bunch of music he worked on in the 80s, which is also the case in part two. You'll find out more about Dave at echobeachmanagement.com. Also, thanks to MJ Brown and Timothy Wales and anybody else who's donated to the podcast or taken the time to send a message. It really does make a difference. I really appreciate it. And if you like the pod, then please leave a message or a rating on iTunes or anywhere else that the Spotify can leave ratings on Spotify, I don't know. But it does help beat the algorithms and push this little podcast out to more people. So as I alluded to in the interview, to a track off the Mike Rutherford Small Creeps Day LP, At the End of the Day, which I first heard on a reduced price Mike and the Mechanics CD single. I think it cost about 20p. And I love this song. And I always assumed Mike sang the vocal because he did sing on at least one solo LP. But no, they're not his vocals. They're by Noel McCallagher, later of the Manfred Mann Earth Band. And I think it's the first, and I can pretty much guarantee the last reference to the Manfred Mann Earth Band there will be on the 80sography podcast. Don't hold me to that. And it reminded me, actually, when I heard this song again, about 25 years ago, I wrote a script for a film called Kingfisher's Dream, which is about a bunch of kids, teenagers on the cusp of adulthood, that do a school project, orientation project in a forest. And there's this killer on the outskirts of the forest. You don't ever see him until the end. And he's picking them off one by one. And it's the idea that they go in as kids, and whoever survives comes out as adults. And the forest represents both, the killer represents both God and also all the fears of adulthood. Tagline, where your childhood ends, your nightmare begins. And at the end, those that survive, they reach Kingfisher's Dream, and they've changed, they're caked in mud and blood, and it's like they've been reborn. And they're standing there looking into the glistening beauty of Kingfisher's Dream, and they're different. And they're staring, they don't look at each other, they don't talk to each other. And then this music comes up, and then we roll credits, and the man reaches for his remote. Netflix, thumbs down. He picks up his phone, looks for a good music podcast to listen to. Downloads latest Rockin' Tours episode. And goes to bed. Good night. Not to him, obviously. Rockin' Tours, sod him. To you, dear listener, to you. Oh, good day.
The eyes of all. is driving me mad. Just in every way. Or bars in the day.